Hey listeners, if you love the show and you want to support This Anthro Life, you can go to anchor.fm and support us by either giving a dollar, $5, or $10. They make it extremely simple and really easy to do, and we appreciate everything that you can offer to help us make this content great.
And now, on to the show. Good afternoon, listeners. We are joined in the studio by your three friends once again here for This Anthropological Life. This is Adam Gamwell.
This is Ryan Collins.
And this is Anil Tripathi.
And today we're going to be exploring a topic that has come up a number of times actually in the previous episodes of our show, but we've never really explicitly dealt with it, and that is visual anthropology. We're dealing specifically with things that we see. Yeah. And kind of the hope with that is to sort of bring to the fore the importance we may put on visual acuity, the way that we see things. We talk about metaphors of let's shed some light on this subject, or even the way that we talk about looking at a monument or something, the way we visualize, we look at things. There's a very sort of unspoken importance we have on using our eyes as sort of the predominant sense, right? And there's certainly, I mean, losing any sense is a terrifying feeling, but again, I think most people may lose the most sleep over if they went blind or something, right? They're losing the ability to see.
I mean, even some of the theoretical fields in anthropology that we use most widely, like landscape, for example, it's based upon seeing and experiencing the surroundings around you, the sort of world of interaction that you can sort of feel and touch, but generally see. You know, landscaping is also referenced through art, through paintings, and Tim Engle does a great job of showing that in one of his articles on the taskscape. But we don't associate usually smell or any type of other sensory thing to it as much as we emphasize visual.
Right. I mean, even notions of photographs and the motion picture and paintings and stuff, these forms of art, you know, for whatever reason, the smell sculpture never took off, right, as a prime way to sort of dedicate one's artistic endeavor to something else.
You know? Although sometimes they do at those, you know, different science conferences and everything, they'll have that little box, right, that you put your nose in and smell it, and you have to guess what it is, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So
that's
there's
true.
Some forms of engagement.
Indeed.
This is true. And often, you know, visual culture seems to overlap with other types of sensory things.
Indeed.
Like we think about foodie culture today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taking that visual of that tasty meat or tasty food or tasty whatever in front of you, but as it's displayed, it's intended to be seen as a sort of creation in its own right.
Right. In that way, food, in that way, can even be a visual art, right? Of course, it can be a gustatory art, too, the proper flavors coming together. But there's something about the well-placed cilantro or the, you know, the perfectly sliced tuna or whatever.
Especially if you think about, like, the Food Network, right? And the kind of place of, you know, food channels and kind of visual media in our culture. I mean, you have the South Park episode where there's, you know, the obsession with the kind of the role of the TV chef. Also, right. So you have food, right, and you can eat food, but then there's also the visual idea of how to prepare food, or you know, all these things that come into play.
Sure. I mean, and there's even some deeper questions we can think about that struck me when thinking about visual anthropology, and one of them has to do with race and gender.
Right.
And again, because these are very visually cued kinds of things, or we think they are, and that's one of the questions. I mean, one of the big pushes that Franz Boas, you know, early 20th century anthropologist pushed was that race is a cultural construction. You know, it deals with, of course, it's related in some ways to skin color, but this is a social condition, a social structure, not a biological one.
Right. And I mean, even going off of what Boas was doing to show this, he was attempting to illustrate that skulls don't conform to specific sizes or shapes, that you can't necessarily take the remains of an individual and say that they were any part of a specific race.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically trying to cut across, you know, categorization, right?
Right.
Through the kind of the objects themselves, right? And trying, and in a way, that's kind of a challenge to how people were visualizing this, right? And how they would lump the skulls in different categories before and have, you know, those infamous depictions in the 1800s, right, of the different human races, right? With different drawings of their skulls and how they would look like, right?
Exactly. I wonder to what extent we still do that today with human origins and how we're piecing together ancient skulls, which may or may not have different phenotypic expressions, that is, looking differently and having expression of different genotypes that allow them to actually be different or segregated in ways that we wouldn't be able to tell by the skull shape alone.
Right, and so that raises questions. I mean, the idea of the genotype and phenotype do raise interesting questions here, because it's the idea of the phenotype, right, are these the physical characteristics that we can see, whether it's plants or animals or whatever organic being. In the genotype, of course, are the switches that turn on those different those visual things in some ways, and other things that we can't see. And it raises questions because we can't see that until the 1990s. We couldn't in the Human Genome Project. We couldn't see the genome really. I mean, obviously, like we quote discovered DNA, but even the fact that Watson and Crick, who discovered it, talked about it as a double helix, that was a visualization of a ladder. That's, you know, you can think about a double helix looks like a ladder twisting around itself. Even that idea. In some ways, I mean, we actually visualize DNA that way, but in some ways that was drawn from what they thought they saw.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So even how we even talk about what DNA is, you know. Mm. And again, you know, to bring that back up to the big scale in terms of race and stuff, right, these ideas we're bringing up about classification, right? Mm-hmm. And that visuality is such a big part of how we classify. We don't really classify people by how they smell. Mm. You know, so you've heard maybe your friend be like, well, that guy smells or something, you know. But normally we don't really classify unless something seems aberrant in that way. But visuality, of course, you know, the eyes are arrested with all sorts of images at all times. And so how we have talked about, you know, we're saying what Boaz is doing with race, he was saying we look at certain things and classify people based on how they look. And that's the phenotype, right?
Right.
But what we're seeing, and which Boaz didn't really know, but we know now that genotypically there's not really a big difference there. You know, in terms of like the genotype of people is the same, even though their phenotypes might be wildly different. Or the fact that we share 98.6% the same DNA as chimpanzees, 42% the same as a banana. You know, and like we look quite different from these
quite
things, you know.
Hopefully.
Right. Hopefully, you know.
It's interesting with this also, right, that we're seeing how kind of there's so much subjectivity in our visual images, right? You think about the double helix and, you know, it didn't have to be that way, right? There could have been other ways of depicting DNA.
Right.
But then that became the tried and true, the most accurate model, right? And then that has an effect.
It does.
And it has an effect in other scientific theories, and it kind of propels itself forward.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
And with all this, we're talking about typing, right? We're talking about genotype.
Yeah.
Being those characteristics of your genetics, you know, within your DNA. The phenotype, that expression. But then we're also talking about archetypes. And we're talking about, what's the word I'm looking for? Stereotypes. Mm. Because we're subjecting different people, different categories, to what we think is supposed to be some sort of expression, some sort of paradigm.
Right.
And we use this all the time.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, when we look at science and technology studies, Michel Caillon talks about this, and that when we're doing measurements of anything, you know, even in order to do a scientific measurement of something, I mean, the what is even measurable is going to be dictated by the technology that we produce to measure it in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, while that may seem weird, because science is purported to us as the thing out, like it's discovering the empirical reality of the world. But Caillon points out that, I mean, and actually, Latour does this too. Bruno Latour, you know, a pretty famous sociologist now for STS, or Science Technology Studies, that these facts are themselves also produced in the same way that our visual registers are, in the same way that we may talk about culture or religion. These ideas are produced through interaction with each other. So are scientific facts. Science, in some ways, is no different.
Right.
And so we have to even be aware of like the materials we're using to see things, right? The way we're using to measure, whether we want to measure the mass of something. How mass is measured is predicated on the fact that we have a machine that measures mass. Right. It's not just that mass exists, but that we can measure it in a certain way. And so the same thing with visuality, right? We're looking at, and again, the example of race, right? What are we using? We're using our eyes in this case. And how do we switch that to then other kinds of ways of seeing it as a social phenomenon that's not as visible or what, you know?
Right. And we make all of our biases based off of the spectrums that we see. We have a very limited light spectrum as humans. So we have a very, you know, dim perspective on the way things look as opposed to birds. And then dogs usually see only in some sort of black and white, some sort of massively colorblind array. So we all have different visual experiences of the world where different things come into focus more for us, and that so much is totally out of focus for us that we will never actually even see.
Right. And then when we do, if we see X-rays or infrared light spectrums, for example, or ultraviolet, right, we can only do so through specific mediums, right? And again, this comes back to what we have to measure. It's entirely possible there are visual spectrums outside of what we have been able to measure, from X-rays to UVs. But again, we just don't have the materials or the technology to do that yet, or actually the conceptual tools to think about that. I know that's kind of a crazy philosophical point, but when we think about it, it's true, right? It's what we're even looking to do is in some way limited by our imagination and the possible. We can imagine there might be something else, but as of right now, I have no idea what that would even look like, right?
What we know, right, is framed by what we don't know.
Right.
And it's our lack of perception that also creates our perception.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think it's also interesting, you know, thinking about what is categorized and what is organized is, you know, in these organizations, as is so much within society and culture, there's power dynamics at play, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking about Michel Foucault and the idea of the panopticon, mm-hmm. right? And the idea of how, you know, seeing is organized and who can see what. And also the kind of I guess, you know, everywhereness of seeing, right? And the idea of the panopticon in that people, you know, they don't know when they're being seen.
Right.
There's this visuality, but it's framed in one direction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and Foucault's second point with that is that that dictates behavior then ultimately, right? It's that if you can be seen at all times, but you don't know when you're being seen, then what he calls is a technology of power, right?
Exactly.
Or a technime, in that it will dictate behavior. This, the panopticon is referring to a prison, and it was seen as sort of the ultimate, you know, Jeremy Bentham invented this, who was a legal scholar. And the idea with this is, of course, right, that you can sort of exercise power without having to actually do anything. If you're
right.
in the middle of the panopticon, you can see all the prisoners at all times, but they can't see you.
Exactly. And this creates a sort of disciplining, self-disciplining environment mm-hmm. in which the prisoners are subject to somebody's gaze, but that somebody may not even be real. You know, they're up in the middle of this tower, which may or may not have a person. It's sort of like the all-seeing eye of Sauron in Lord of
yeah.
the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. This eye is watching you. And if you fall upon its gaze, you know, the doom becomes the all, right?
The orcs come after you, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's terrifying. But we see parallels to this all around us today.
Oh, yeah.
And so much of our modern sort of culture in the West has become under the influence of this in so many ways through digital media and Facebook being a huge thing that people often talk about with panopticon relations.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's this monitoring, you know, and I think we looked up before the show the idea of selfies as being a, which is taking a
now
photograph
a mental
of yourself.
Illness.
It's now a mental illness, you know, and by the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, I think volume 5 is out now, or 4 or 5, I'm not sure. But it's interesting. I mean, even the idea of taking a photograph of oneself, and I mean, even the idea of photographs, we have talked about that in an episode with a former guest, Ben Gibo, last year. We did one specifically on photography, and we talked a bit about the rise of photography and when it came up around the 1860s, and that there's a real ambivalence to taking photographs. And if we think about the idea of the visual image, taking a picture, taking a photograph, in relation to what we were saying about the panopticon of being always watched, and also how we classify people, I mean, the idea of the photograph when it first came out was used, not surprisingly, by law enforcement agencies as a way to document criminality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think about it, there's this seeming relation between the image of you and your personality and your type. And of course, I mean, there's actually like they would hand out you know, images of people saying this is what a criminal looks like, and it's just a picture of a guy.
And mugshots.
And mugshots, right? Yeah.
Right. Mm. And it wouldn't take anything into consideration, such as, you know, genotype or bodily experiences and harms, things that, you know, shape the way we look.
Right.
And just what we do in our day to day lives. A lot of the people that, you know, we're being subject to these things. We're like steel mill workers and different mm-hmm. types of laborers who are subject to lots of harsh conditions, which have a bad impact on the way your physique looks.
So you're right. So you'd see a specific kind of body
right.
that would be photographed over and over again. And think about it, this is not that different from racial profiling now.
Exactly.
Right? We just talk about it a little differently.
Yeah. And it's amazing, right, how our perceptions can be framed so much as by what we see. And then it'll continually kind of enforce itself, such as, you know, in a lot of psychology textbooks, they have the infamous photograph from the early 1900s of the baseball team of workers who worked in an asylum.
Mm.
So all of their shirts say asylum on them, right? So
yeah.
when a lot of people look at this picture initially, they think that these are mental illness patients. So they look at these faces and they look, oh, these are all disturbed faces. But of course, these are the people who are working
right.
in
right.
the asylum clinic. But the ideas and perceptions we have then frame how we receive the picture.
Exactly. And it's great to think about how our perceptions and framing of, you know, different categories, different visual categories, change our perceptions of social groups over time. So I remember in some English lit courses I took in college, there was a big discussion about how a tanned individual may be shown as being a beautiful person in a book from the 18th century, but that wasn't referencing beauty. It was referencing that this was somebody who usually worked in the fields. Like, people didn't have tans.
Right.
Why would you spend so much time in the sun?
Right. And so even that, I mean, the idea, the visual ideas of beauty, right, will change
uh-huh.
over time.
Exactly.
And of course, if you even think about it now, it's like, you know, when we get into the idea, as we've been talking about race, I mean, there still are notions of, you know, whiteness, brownness, blackness that circulate, of course, you know, here in Boston, right, anywhere. And you'll see that, you know, there's certain, like, there's an idea you want to be kind of tan, but not too tan if you're seen as too white, you know.
Right.
And, like, I've heard people say this, and it sounds, you know, as an anthropologist, this strikes me a little weird, and as a person that, you know, race is a social category, not a biological thing. Like, it kind of messes with me. But, you know, it raises interesting questions of, like, there's, like, spectrums that people want to find themselves on. Or you'll see in India there's whitening cream that you can use to lighten your skin. And so, I mean, obviously this has the influence of sort of European colonialism writ large, you know, over the past 500 years. But, I mean, and beyond. But it really raises interesting questions of, like, how we see even the notions of, this phenotype, right, which now can be changed. Whether you want to doctor a photograph, you want to put on whitening cream, or you want to spend more time in the sun, you know, we actively alter sort of what our skin conditions might be, right?
Exactly. And, you know, since we brought up South Park earlier, South Park recently did an episode talking about how people are using Photoshop to enhance their bodily images, to present something that would be more of an idealized version of themselves rather than show the norm, the undoctored, this is how I am every day.
Yeah.
Because that's become a huge part of our culture.
It is. I mean, and again, it just brings us back to the importance of, or the power, really, of the image, right? I mean, and we can, you know, we probably should just jump back in time here because we're, you know, we started the 1860s when we had the daguerreotype and, like, the first sort of photographs that could be used. The difference between a daguerreotype and a camera is that daguerreotype would use on silver plating and take an image, and so you can't reproduce that image. It would just be that one. Mm-hmm. Of course, now we have digital iPhone burst photos. You hit it, it takes five, and then you choose the best one, or your phone chooses it for you, you know, based on whatever selection criteria of non-blurriness or whatever.
Yeah. No, a massive amount of visual data. I'm sure, you know, Charles Baudelaire would be turning over in his grave.
Yeah.
Of course, he had so many things to say about the daguerreotypes, right, and how they created, you know, they were basically they just kind of emphasized the kind of anomie, the alienation in society. In that you had this image of yourself that which was then separate.
Right.
As we became more and more separated from ourselves in society and separate from society at large.
Yeah.
Right. In the alienation of the city, the idea of we're becoming, you know, less and less, you know, as persons, but more of just types.
Right.
Right. And I mean, we think about this historically. I mean, we look into the past, when people had sculptures or they had paintings done of them, these were intended to be ideals. And that's something that seems to hold true cross-culturally. We see this with the ancient Maya, with sculptures being, you know, showing representations of people with skull modifications, but often such an ideal of that practice that it wasn't actually mirroring the physical way that people actually looked. And then we see this again throughout, you know, medieval Europe with busts being made of, you know, elites and noblemen, and same thing with the pictures of themselves as well.
And these ideals, right, they reflect so much of, you know, how our society starts to see things.
Right.
And has this kind of building effect. I mean, similar to how Susan Sontag in On Photography, she describes how she sees, you know, photographic tourism as kind of also similar to Baudelaire, showing kind of a hollowing out of society. Mm-hmm. And that people, you know, are always kind of working to a degree. You think about tourists who will always bring their cameras everywhere and take pictures of all these things. They're producing something, right? They're producing this visual data, even on vacation.
Right.
It's production, right? But then this production is always almost very limited to the certain types of shots that are taken. Like you have to get, you know, if you're in Paris, you have to get a picture with the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
You know, in London, picture with Big Ben. In New York, Statue of Liberty. It's this kind of hollowing out of the experience through photography.
That's very interesting.
And I mean, even the idea that, again, because in the 1950s, I think is when camera prices finally became sort of, and think about this as no coincidence, at the same time as the rise of the middle class family in the United States. And with this rise of middle class, a little more disposable income, the idea of the, you know, the ideal family, you know, the white picket fence, 2.5 kids and a dog, and you got your pension job, etc. These ideas, you know, photography came up with these, the idea of photographing the events. And you know, Sontag points out, and Baudelaire was talking about too, this notion of that this is the first time, and again, Baudelaire was writing in I think the 1870s or 80s, he's a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea there is that you can now for the first time see yourself outside of yourself. You know, you see a mirror image of yourself walking by, okay, it moves with you, but then an image is just there. And that idea is only compounded into the idea of the American family, in that even when you're on vacation, like you're taking photographs to remember it when you're not on a vacation anymore. And so this production actually is in some ways, some you know, people lament that it takes you out of the actual thing of being on vacation or being anywhere. Like, I mean, even being at the bar with your friends or going out somewhere, you know, you want to make sure to get a good shot. Like, I wish I took a picture of that. I can put it on Facebook or Instagram or Pinterest or whatever. Like, the idea is you want to have these images to remember to document what you did later. But in some ways, you know, is that sort of – is visually registering the event pulling you away from being in the event at that time?
Well, That's a good argument. A lot of people are talking about how memory is becoming more fleeting because we spend so much time documenting as opposed to actually experiencing. So that's why some people have taken to new forms of either changing the way we creatively employ, you know, photographic media, or we do something different with those photographs in a way that creates something new. So one thing I'm thinking of in particular is a couple people have now done this. I can't remember specifically who, but people are taking an image of their child, one image every day, and they did this for like 18 years. And you see the progression of how this child grew over this 18 years, and it is astounding because you start to see minor nuances, minor differences building up into these features, which change over time. And that blows my mind.
Yeah.
But another way of going about this visual media in a different way are the GoPro cameras. Just having something that's on you that you don't know necessarily what you're filming, or you station it somewhere, and it documents while you still experience.
Right. And yeah, the GoPro cameras are these little, you know, I don't know, fat credit cards, you know, that that you can put anywhere, and they're picked up by extreme sports people, you know, a way to like document you and your buddies doing half pipes. But Ryan and I actually were fortunate to go see a documentary called Leviathan by Lucien Caston Taylor as the director, and we got to see it last week. And this film is a documentary of basically the New Bedford fishing industry, but the way Caston Taylor likes to do documentary film is really kind of close in your face, and a lot of it was made with GoPros and that they would put on the fishermen's bodies, and so a lot of it was really sort of dislocated. And the idea, and like, so this, you know, really got us thinking about the visuality aspect of what a documentary film can do, or how films work. And so, I mean, even the beginning of the film itself, you know, you just see these weird colors kind of swirling until slowly you realize that the camera's on somebody's jacket, mm-hmm. and that he's then, you know, basically winching chains off the back of it with somebody else. And then you come to see it, but it's really powerful, like single shot for 20 minutes. Kind of nauseating because, you know, whenever a camera's on a body, it's pretty shaky. But even like what the film can do in that case, and so much of it, like he would just literally put one of the GoPro cameras in the fish pit. And where it's just really this up close, gruesome, you know, images of you know, fish with their bladders hanging out of their mouths and their eyes popping because they've just been trawled across the ocean floor with two tons of their buddies, you know.
And this whole visual experience was mind blowing. Honestly, it created this just complete sense of unease throughout the entire film, which I think is something you can definitely do with visual anthropology that I think Lucien did in a way that was unparalleled. My opinion. But you've also seen his other works.
Yeah, he also made a previous film called Sweetgrass, which was different, but it was actually about a Montana sheep herding family and group. And it was interesting because it was, you know, they raised some questions about what he's trying to do, because again, there was a sort of a sheep herding industry, and this was about, you know, the New Bedford fishing industry, which, by the way, I didn't know it was about the New Bedford fishing industry until Caston Taylor was at the Q&A after the film. That's when he said that. I had no idea. You know, I thought we were in the middle of, you know, Alaska. You know, you have no idea. Like, you see Day twice in the entire film. Mm-hmm. And then Sweetgrass, I knew before, and that it was about a Montana thing. And you can tell you're on a sheep farm, which is a little different, you know. But it's great because in both of these films, what Caston Taylor's trying to do is, again, change our visual register of what a film and a documentary can be. There's virtually no talking.
Right.
And then in Sweetgrass, he's trying to, in some ways, he says, it wasn't so much to humanize the sheeps, but to bestialize the human and to make us realize that these things go together. And even the idea of Leviathan for the second film, that was just sort of humans and machines and fish, and you really can't distinguish between them. You can see a person walking on the boat, but the way that the chains are moving and the fish bodies and the parts, like, they're just like, the thing is the Leviathan, right? And this is sort of a reference to the biblical creature in the book of Job as this like behemoth beast.
And it's all one and the same because, you know, the machine itself appears so organic. And as you bring up the chains, you know, the chains themselves become these organic pieces of the Leviathan.
They almost look like tentacles,
exactly, you know? Because the water is just flowing off of them, and then ropes give them this feel, that this visual feel that there's some sort of texture, like skin to them. And it's just unnerving and yet mind-blowing how all these pieces fit together.
It is. And even so, his work on Sweetgrass, too, it does point to these. It has just these long shots of sheep getting sheared, and like how they get up, drag them, put them on their back, shave them up, push them down this little chute, and they kind of run out. And like, so just literally, you're watching this for like 20 minutes, and then, then finally it follows one out the chute, and then it just, you know, kind of trots back, you know, goes over to its family, and it's just like looking around, like, what just happened?
Are you actually describing a sheep slide?
Yeah, there's a sheep slide. Yes, there's a little chute they push them down. You know, and the other scenes of them just literally just standing there watching the field. And so it seems, you know, for a film, we expect, you know, changing images every 10 seconds or something to kind of keep your visual register. But this is literally just watching, and this is what it would be like to actually see it in some ways.
Right.
And again, even the idea of talking with people, like it's very few. And so you get this really subjectivity that's sort of these two different animals, sheep and people, kind of just doing their thing in the same space. I mean, obviously we can put a narrative to that in right. capitalist enterprise and the lowering of you know, farm labor, you know, devaluing it, et cetera, but at the same time, and same with Leviathan too. Like that was actually one of the points the panelists brought up, that like, are we seeing the merging of technology and human capital and like the onslaught of capitalism in compelling to anthropological thought? But even the director was like, I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, I could theorize that, but really I was actually trying to do something visually different. And so that made us say, let's think about this, you know, what is he doing? And is this about like, how do we put things together even for us as anthropologists or people thinking, right? How do we put together images we see, visuality, as well as maybe some theoretical thoughts, or should we not do that all the time?
And the visual was such an emphasis for this because, again, not only did he say that you know, he didn't know in relationship to those theory things, but he brought up the other documentaries he had seen had used this type of film techniques, had used cameras. So he wanted to do something he had never seen before.
Yes.
And getting back to those discussions of what language was used in the film, the one time we actually have language used in a way that's meant to convey something as opposed to disembodied voices or a TV screen that is static, you know, it's in writing. And it's in writing that was unnervingly done in a sort of font that was very difficult to read.
Yes.
But that was the intent.
Right. Yeah, the font, the credits in the beginning and the end, I mean, I couldn't even read them. It was like this really weird jagged font.
Very intelligible.
Exactly. Yeah. So even when language was a part of this, it was intended to be seen and not intended to be heard.
Yeah, or read in that way, right? And so, I mean, again, just the idea of visual registers is I don't know, so interesting. You know, documentary is a great way to think about that. I mean, because I'm sure, I mean, I know all three are talking about them, or like we've seen, you know, anybody who's listening has seen a documentary too, or just a television show or a commercial, like the different kinds of ways images are flashed at you, you know. But also the question of, like, why is it important to then continually push the envelope of things that we can visually see? Again, that's what Cassian Taylor was pointing to. Like, I didn't want to make, you know, a film that we'd seen before. Because he originally said they got these HDR cameras and we're just kind of filming in HD. And then he realized, we've seen this before. It's just we're looking at a fishing boat. This looks too much like The Deadliest Catch, you know. And so then
Jaws,
right, you know. So they just changed it to where they have this, you know, these little GoPros that literally put you in the muck.
Exactly.
And it's interesting, you know.
So speaking more about visuality and language, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with this new technology that people are purporting. I was listening to it on a podcast earlier today called Spritz. And this idea is that words will be flashed upon the screen in a way that doesn't make your eyes have to move. So your eyes don't have to focus in or focus out, that they can just be still, and you watch everything flashed at you, and you can supposedly speed read in a way that's unprecedented because your eyes have to do half the work.
Yeah, I've actually been playing with that. There's another one called Spreeder.
Oh, yeah?
Spreeder.com. And yeah, Spritz actually, because they're getting a lot of press because they're like the new big one, because what they actually did, the one thing they added was, you know, all it does is it just flashes one word, or you can actually pick, you know, one or two, three, up to six words, how many you want and how fast you want them at a time, so you can sort of supposedly speed read. I think it probably works okay for novels. When it comes down to, like, I'm trying to read anthropology, it's like, no, hold on. You know, there's too many words that are like 35 letters long.
Yes.
Especially if you have to reflect on things, right?
Exactly, yeah. You want to think about it. So if you want to just, like, you know, blaze through Harry Potter, it might be a little do. And I think there's something valuable about it, but it also speaks to our need for trying to do things visually faster.
Right.
And it's an interesting idea. I mean, I'm interested to see it. And so the idea is, they said it was like, you know, something, I get them, the numbers are mixed up in my head, but 20 or 80%, so either one, of energy reading is actually your eyes moving across the page.
Right.
These things just, you know, this is the idea, is you can just look straight at one spot and it flashes the words at you. And Spritz, of course, makes one letter red. And so that way your eye can stay very in the exact same spot. And also on top of that is this notion of sub-vocalization. When you're reading, then you kind of say, you'll find, even if you're not saying them, your throat will be kind of saying the words.
Right.
The idea is to get out of that habit because you can read faster, supposedly. But again, you know, there's sort of kickback about that, saying, well, we can see faster, but we can't, as you're saying, Anil, we can't comprehend faster, though.
Right.
Or can we? I don't know.
And then if you hit a word that you don't necessarily know.
Right. It just keeps going, you know. And so it's like, you know, I find, you know, you got to, like, stop and think about the sentence or think about the paragraph or something. Uh-huh.
And this is really just a way to filter in images and words into your eyes.
Right.
It's like shoveling food into your mouth nonstop, and then if you need to take a breath, you where does it go?
Exactly, right, yeah.
Seems like it's almost trying to break down the filter. And it almost seems similar to Leviathan, right? And how he's saying, you know, he's trying to get us to see something that we haven't seen before.
Right.
Right, so it's all about, you know, changing, either opening up or, you know, just morphing our filter of visual data.
Well, I mean, even it's interesting, too, because this technology is called, like, RSVP. It's like Rapid Sight Visual Perception or something. And it's been around since the 70s. And so they've been doing it. I don't know if they used flash cards or what. But they had something else that was not, you know, a nice little iPhone screen. They've been doing this for about 30 years. And so it's interesting because the technology itself isn't new. Why it's now suddenly becoming popular because of Spritz,
right.
I don't know. I mean, because I hadn't heard of Spritz. Somebody else told me about Spreeder. And then suddenly there's this big buzz about Spritz. And so it raises questions of, like, why this – it's been 40 years since they started using this. And why now is it suddenly becoming this thing? You know, I don't know, but it's...
And hearing about this, the first thing that came to me were those old scenes from the movie, Stanley Kubrick's movie, A Clockwork Orange, in which the protagonist, antagonist of the film, the dark main character, is forced to watch visual scenes with his eyes open and unblinking as a means of, you know, psychologically changing him to reintegrate him into society, and it's a form of torture.
Yes, yeah.
And that's exactly what came to my mind when thinking about this media.
It is interesting, though, right? Because, I mean, in Clockwork Orange, you see his eye, you know, twitching everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? His pupil, that's one of the scariest things in the movie, I feel, is that you see this kind of overload of information.
Right.
But then if Spritz is trying to do this system, right, where it's actually less work for your eye.
Right.
That's interesting, right? And how it's almost, it's altering the way that, we, you know, our eyes are kind of perceiving.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like raises these questions of sort of how we filter information, right? Whether it's, because I mean, the eye at any time, the human eye takes in such a wealth of information. Of course, like anything, like language too, we filter it in our heads before we realize it and then categorize it, as we've been kind of saying the whole show. But then the question is, if we change that, what does that mean for us thinking? You know, how has it changed us the way that we think about the world, to see the world? Is like, if we do change how fast we see words and just words versus, I mean, imagine if you watched a movie in fast forward, would that do the same thing? You know, I mean, obviously the visual field's a bit bigger than looking at a single word. But maybe if you made the visual field really tiny, you know, and watched a movie and fast forward really small, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't know. Is that doable too? But, you know, why would that seem less pleasurable than reading a book with one word at a time?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think especially looking at different types of visual media is very interesting, right? I mean, I've had this, I mean, thinking about even running things in fast forward, right? We do that very little now, I think, compared to what we did in the past with VHSs, where you had to run it.
Right, yeah,
Fast forward if you wanted to get to a place or rewind.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, right, because it's almost, I think that's the real differences between these medias. I mean, people, you know, thinking about sound, a lot of people argue there's a difference between, you know, the sound of a turntable versus a CD versus digital, you know, music. But I think really a lot of these things is really just the whole experience of putting it together. Or, you know, what are the differences in the media itself? Like with the VHS, that kind of scratchiness that comes up at time, you know, the white flecks that'll come up on the screen. And these are, you know, these have effects, I think. Just, you know, the way that we present the media.
Right.
It's similar, you know, watching a movie on your laptop versus going to a movie theater.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the audiovisual experience, right? The sound and the visual. And it's true. Like, even remember back watching VHS when I was a kid, you know, it is. Like, the quality is markedly different. Or why we pushed to 1080p now, and now there's 4K beyond that, you know.
Exactly.
And even the fact that, I mean, what was interesting about this, like, sort of the rise, because, you know, they talk about it, this is Ultra HD, is 1080p. And now there's 4K, so now it's like Super Ultra HD or some crap. They keep changing the name, and there's going to be something above that, of course, too. I mean, video cameras or movie cameras themselves film, like, the whatever the thing above 4K is. I don't know the numbers. So, I mean, we're going to run out of, like, visual of what we can do until we invent new cameras after that one.
Right.
Sure we will, right?
Yeah, and we will, of course, going. You know. And that's kind of the question, too, because even the way we film these things, are, you know, we watch films, like, they're in such definition that we can't see all. I mean, it actually reminds me of the painting style that came out in the 50s and 60s called photorealism, right? And this push to sort of paint these hyper-realistic images. And one of the things that marked photorealism as different from photography, because, again, some people, this wonderful talent, actually here at the Rose Museum at Brandeis, we do have some nice images that are photorealistic of a motorcycle, of a gas station. But the difference between, like, photorealism and photography is that, so if we take a photograph, and because of the way the lens works in our eyes too, we focus on one thing and something else in the background or foreground or whatever is going to be out of focus. photorealism takes everything and puts it in focus. So it's this hyper-realistic image that you can't – I mean, normally you couldn't see anything, everything anyway.
Exactly.
But the way they do it is that then now everything is down. So they, you know, they take like five photographs of the same thing with different parts in focus, put those together and paint that. And it's a really interesting idea. And I mean, films still do the in-focus, out-of-focus thing too. But even they, with the advent of 3D images with it, like you, it juxtaposes this in and out of focus. And so I mean, there's this playing with like what we can actually see through painting anyway in this case. I don't know, that I find striking. I mean, I think it's one of the most striking forms of painting that we've seen in the past 100 years.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. And like many of the visual examples we've been talking about today, you have a visceral reaction to these type of things.
Yeah.
Because your eyes, your mind, they all recognize that there is something about this that you shouldn't be able to see. Something is not right.
Right.
So we walk away with that experience feeling sort of, I don't know if unnerved is the right word here, but you don't feel right. Something is off.
What even the idea of I mean, so many films now, I mean, just to pick any major Hollywood blockbuster, The Hobbit, has so many scenes of slow motion action now, too, right? Because normally you couldn't see, and there's like the really slow running away from the fire or whatever. I mean, any film you can think of right now.
300. I mean,
the entire movie is slow motion, right?
Exactly.
If it was regular speed, the movie would be like 20 minutes, you know, but it's like an hour and a half because everything is in slow motion.
Exactly. And speaking of Photoshop, I heard that the second one had much more Photoshopping to make everybody look as ripped and muscular as possible.
Thinking about idealized images again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, right? And the thing, I mean, and particularly the ideal image of the Greek soldier, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's a big, that's one of the big spots we saw, the idea of the ideal image popping up, you know, of the idealized male figure anyway, you know, that we still hold to today, which is kind of crazy if we think about this. We're talking about ancient Greece here.
It's a long time.
A long time ago, you know, we're talking a couple thousand years, and like we still, like that's still this idea of this idealized. I mean, like it makes me want to think of like the Venus of Willendorf, you know, these like nice, obese statues of women, potentially fertility goddesses we don't entirely know. But
right.
I mean, imagine that too is another wonderful idealized image of the female body, you know, quite different.
Exactly. And I also think of like ancient Maya sculpture. And you don't usually have a male figure that's muscular and bustling represented. You have people with sometimes, you know, pretty big sizable bellies.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be sitting down and they'll be attended to by people who are of a smaller stature than them, enforcing the ideal of being larger, of being bigger.
Yeah. I mean, so even how we use visual registers like that to indicate hierarchies, right?
Exactly.
In idealized form, like as well as size, too, you know, and that some things are seen as, quote, better than other ones, you know, depending on. And the interesting thing is, of course, these visual registers change. We're talking about, you know, Greek to Roman to now to whenever. You mentioned skin color before. Mm-hmm. It's like, again, these are classificatory systems, right? And they're really, and again, based on the visuality of our eyes. I mean, we think about that too. I mean, imagine if like Jose Saramago's book Blindness. You know, it's like, what if we all just went blind for a little while? You know, it's like, how would that change the entire functioning of how things work? I mean, the idea of traffic lights in elevators and all these things. I mean, the way they're written,
right,
or produced, are really made for the visually, you know, parable, I guess, and like. You know, it's interesting to think of, in some ways, why did, you know, we can just, you know, we can't think of a teleology saying it went from here to here, and this is the reason we have it, but, like, why are things so visually set up in our world versus olfactory smelling or sound?
And so many of our laws are set up visually, right? I mean, mentioning the stop signs, red lights, and traffic signals.
Right.
And then thinking about, you know, ways that we've tried to adapt it, right? If you think about, in the subway, the kind of bumpy line right next to the tracks.
Yes, yeah.
You know, for the blind so that they don't go over. So
right.
We have to create these different types of cues.
Yes.
And I think it's definitely true. Right? In our society, our cues are overwhelmingly visual in so many arenas.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's curious to think about, you know, why that might be the case. Or since it is, I mean, what else could we do with these kinds of things? I mean, I'm thinking here of a work by Stephen Feld. He's an acoustomologist, and he works in Borneo, I believe. And he talks about, I may have that totally wrong, but yeah, but he does sort of acoustic anthropology. And so in the group that he works with, you know, they live in dense jungle. And so visual, you know, we may think of, oh, I can see my friend walking up the bike path, you know, or walking up the field or something. It's not the case there. I mean, you're in this dense forest in which you can't see, and so actually sound becomes one of the main ways in which you identify by whistling, by saying certain shouts, so you know who's around you. And usually it's actually done by whistling, because the case is they don't want to like scare away an animal or something if they're hunting, or just so you know who's there or who's singing or something. So it's not even like, hey, I'm over here. It's just this whistling you'll hear. And so this really wonderful idea that like that visuality is of course part of it. Well, we think of the dense jungle and there's just plants everywhere, but they work around that and say it's actually by we hear where my friends are, where my people are, or my food is. And so, I mean, obviously that's a different adaptation, which, you know, as we always see, humans are good at adapting to whatever, but it raises questions of, you know, if that's the case there, you know, what does it mean for us to be so visually queued up here?
You know, and it makes me think about some other things, like the similar situations, but in very opposite settings. Hmm. So we see this with, ancient Greek and Roman runes. We have the sort of Western formalization of the amphitheater, right? The place where you can go on stage and practice, and there's the emphasis on the acoustics that can be played within this echoing type of platform, and the visual gaze being downward, yes. Like in a stadium. And we're, you know, you look down to the stage, you hear the voices bouncing all around you, creating a huge effect. That's not the way that you would see it if people were just performing on a level stage in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's key. You know, I mean, there's something about, yeah, even the way that our levels are, you know, that
exactly.
We still use, you know, the stadium is the same format now. You know, is that the best way to have a stadium? I don't know, but you know, we like something about it. You know,
yeah. I think with all of this, we see really just the importance of framing experiences and framing, you know, the visual. You know, this weekend I was at the American Ethnological Society conference in Boston, and there was a media maker session, and people were talking about, you know, the differences between ethnographic film and other types of documentary. How, you know, you frame a story visually. One of the films was about gentrification in Durham around Duke University, right? And how they framed it was very important for them. They showed one interview with someone who's basically being kicked out of their neighborhood and showing, you know, the images of the McMansions being built up. And the whole interview, I was actually wondering whether they'd done this on purpose or not, because during the interview, you always heard cars going by very loudly. Is because it seemed that they were doing the interview right on the intersection. And it seemed almost, it was almost fitting in how it was described, this person almost getting pushed off, right, and getting, you know, sound out. Alternatively, it could have just been, you know, they did an interview with cars right next to it and they didn't know how to filter out the sound. But it's interesting, right? There are all these ideas of, you know, what are, you know, the implications and what is the impetus behind different visual creation. I mean, similar to how the director of the Leviathan, right? He acknowledging the response of the audience, right? Talking about capitalism and whatnot, and then he says, right? It's, you know, he doesn't know if it's there.
Yeah.
So you create things, right? But then it's very interesting to think what happens afterwards, right? Because once you put it in the public domain, these visual things, you know, similar to other symbols, they take on a life of their own.
Exactly, and we can think about that with any type of text, really. I mean, thinking about 300 or a parallel of, you know, the Odyssey and Homer's Iliad. We see different versions of this come in time and time again, different interpretations of the stories. And this started off as a poem that was meant to be read. You know, this is something that was meant to be performed to people, with the visual being emphasized on a single individual, emphasizing different characters. But now we think about Brad Pitt as Achilles and, you know, how many different types of gigapan cameras can we use to try and create the image of a Troy that we now believe is real, as opposed to being the sort of mythos that people once had it? This life just takes on different forms again and again and again, becoming different.
I think it's incredibly interesting, right, to think about that projection of the Iliad and the Odyssey into even text form as being a visualization. Right, so even that level is a visualization. Then it goes on, and we have these blockbuster Hollywood films and whatnot.
Yeah,
but you know, all of these things are dealing with the visual.
Yeah, that's. I mean, what strikes me about what you said is the idea of textuality, right? And this came up. The idea of textuality, you know, kind of rose up with the notion of postmodernism, that people are talking about things can be read, and even of course, let's do the metaphor here, right? Things can be read. This is a visual metaphor anyway. But textuality is that a coffee cup can be read, not as saying, oh, this says it's from Einstein or Starbucks, but it, like, we can read this as a cultural text that tells us about production, consumption, whatever. And the idea, even to that, I mean, that we've taken sort of the visual media metaphor from even like telling like the idea of like the oral performance of the Odyssey to now reading it for high school to now watching Brad Pitt fight it out with Eric Bana.
Exactly.
You know, to whatever. And like, and but now saying this is a textual, these are textuality things, but then we can apply the exact same thing to a coffee cup now.
Right.
And, you know, it's in some ways I find it a little whelming, you know, perhaps over, you know, maybe not overwhelming, but at least whelming, right? That like everything is now like where everything is fair game as being a text.
It's very true. I mean, you know, Ian Hodder focuses on this for archaeology very much specifically. So, an edited, not an edited volume, but a book that he keeps putting out every once in a while, and now with a co-author, name is escaping me at the moment. But he's a Mayanist, so I'll give the shout
out.
He'll
come back,
Rev. Right. And this book is called Reading the Past. And it's taking that idea that the artifacts of the past are visual texts that can be read to elicit a specific type of story. And then he's gone so far to suggest in newer works, in a book called Entanglement, that we can create the sort of sensory and emotional effect that's connected to some certain materials, that you can find the entanglement that people once had to, say, their coffee cup on a day-to-day basis and get that more emotional, visceral connection to the materials, and we can read that. I'm a little hesitant on the degree to which we can do this, but it's a compelling idea.
It is. I mean, it just gets us at the idea of, like, what about... Because, you know, in the phenomenologist camp, which is the idea of looking at pure experience, and, like, how do we talk about the science of experience? How do I feel and smell?
Right.
And then we have this idea of sort of reading textual objects that go with it, and I can see they're kind of in tension, because it's like, how much can we actually know about how somebody else experiences the world?
Exactly.
And for a bunch of neurons and, you know, in senses. I think it is compelling to think about. I mean, I don't know either. I'm not really sure. But
one of the examples he uses is a clay ball that was found at the site of Çatalhöyük, which is one of the oldest known cities in Turkey, right? And in this place, he found a clay ball. And in this now hardened, very hardened clay ball, you can see the impressions of where a child had bit into it. So you see the impressions of teeth that are left over there, and how his argument goes that there's a connection this child has to this, and you can sort of get that taste of the clay that would have gone along with this. You can create the visual of seeing somebody do that.
Yeah.
It's really giving an imprint. And then another comparable example would be like handprints inside of a cave, where you see that there's often a hand inside of old ancient caves, and then some sort of spit-on lacquerish paint around it, and you get the sensation that once upon a time someone held their hand and this wet wall of a cave and then sprayed it with paint.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, so much of this idea of textuality is that, like, it takes what might be a static image and then adding process to it, right?
Exactly.
And adding, you know, seeing it as being alive, I guess.
Yeah, and in archaeology especially, right, there seems to be so many visual elements involved, right? If you think about how sites are mapped out, how images are then created, right, based on the artifacts, it's almost similar to how the double helix was visualized by Crick and Watson.
And you brought up a fantastic point with the double helix, that it could have taken on any number of different forms. The way we think of the double helix now is just one form of many different ways we could have, you know, thought about this, that we could have taken it as a symbol. And we do this with archaeology. In building a site, you know, every site that I've been working on has a mapping project, has a mapping component. How are we going to define the boundaries? How are we going to define the territory? What are the buildings that need to be emphasized? And we could do this any number of different ways. And we've done it in any number of different ways.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's why it's just important for us to recognize. And this, you know, certainly, I think, emphasizes the reflexive turn anthropology started taking in the 1980s, right, that we have to recognize our choices in the production of knowledge.
Exactly.
And this goes for anybody. This is an anthropologist, but all of us. And that's also why science and technology studies have been so important, why it is a textuality have become so important. I mean, even talking about how we visually categorize things, right, it's important for us to sort of take responsibility and be aware of the actual productive process. Again, Calon's saying we can only measure things based on what we have that we have to measure them with. We can only measure mass if we know... have a mass spectrometer that can measure mass, right? And we have to be aware of that, you know. And it's doesn't make anything less real or anything less scientific, right? But
no.
You know, I'm going to say two phrases together. Like Mulder would say, I want to believe that the truth is out there. And in some ways, it might be, but at the same time, that truth is just often is constructed by what we can see the truth to be,
right?
Than what it actually is, too. And we just got to be, you know, it's key to be aware of that. And in some ways, visuality, I think, draws us to that in a very visceral way, perhaps.
And I'll reference Ian Hodder's work again. And his work, Reading the Past, was done with Scott Hudson, as well as Scott Hudson of the University of Kentucky. Now, but he also brings up the idea of truth. And this whole reading the past, it's not about reading the truth, but reading a truth. What is that subjective truth that we can get at? Because there are many different levels of truth. Our truth as a researcher, our truth as an archaeologist, our truth as a graduate student doing whatever work you might be doing there.
Right.
And then the social truths that people would have had as different classes, as different people, different individuals, and how those play out. And how is the story that we're truly going to create, that we want to visualize, going to come into being?
And all this, we really see how, you know, any visuality in itself is kind of an assemblage, right? These are assemblages coming together of all of these different truths. And, you know, at times, certain truths stand out more than others. You know, it depends on where your focus is. You know, going back, you think about photography, right? Where you focus your image on.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, of course, now, like, we extend that metaphor because of Photoshop, you can change where that focus is, or, you know, what images look like. So, but it makes sense. It's because, I mean, it's the same thing. The truth, in some ways, in this case, is process, too, right? There are... We can get at facets of human experience, certainly, I think, you know, by our scientific methods and our humanistic methods in anthropology and archaeology and linguistics, you know, biological anthropology. But again, right, these are processual truths in some ways.
Yes.
Right? And I mean, or Bourdieu says they're practical truths, they're practices, right? Or William James talks about pragmatics. I mean, not linguistically, but the thing that, like, things are real when they have, when they affect your world, is what he says. And things are true when they affect our experience of reality. And, you know, that in some ways, that's got to be... enough. It doesn't have to, we don't have to stop it necessarily, but that's somewhere to latch onto, though.
For sure. And even Latour talks about this, because he talks about the thing becoming a thing after it's defined through a trial.
Yes.
That we don't define what it is until we've had to go through a sort of crisis moment of how is it going to be in the first place, such as the double helix.
Right. It's like, why are we seeing this sort of thing emerge? Oh, now it's a double helix. Good. Look at that. appropriately so, too. Well,
there you go. It's a lot of stuff. I mean, I think... You know, it's amazing, right, just how much is involved in visuality. And we're doing it all the time, right, as long as we have our eyes open. Or even when we have our eyes shut, and we're still visualizing.
And speaking of that today, we may be going about visuality in a new way, because Google just released its Google Glass to the public today.
Oh. Well, we're about
especially thinking about the Panopticon, right, or just, you know, constantly looking.
Right.
And because there, in so many of the demos, right, they show how you can just play the video whenever you want, right? Or you can start recording whenever you want.
Yeah.
So you could be walking around. And, of course, this has actually become an issue in restaurants, right? There have actually been some restaurants that have banned the Google Glass, saying that, you know, it's an invasion of privacy because these other patrons in the restaurant don't know if this person's recording them or not.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, even, like, it's funny because we've seen some of that issue with in terms of whether it's citizens' rights to film a police act or not, you know, if somebody else is filming somebody being pulled over, if that's illegal or not. And the verdict is not out. So I can see Google Glass doing the same kind of thing. It's like, is it okay? How does permission come into this, right? And, of course, like, if we're talking about recording video, when is that okay, you know? And do we have to have permission or not?
We may need to have a follow-up visuality episode to talk about how Google Glass has impacted the experience of visuality in about a year or so.
Once we all get our Google Glasses.
And once we get our glasses,
Once we get grants to use this for our project.
Pay for them for themselves,
If anyone from Google's listening, send them over.
We'll be happy to try them out for you. I'm not going to guarantee they're going to wear them, but we'll try them out for you. Yeah, thanks for joining us today on This Anthropological Life. It's been a visual adventure. We've seen a lot of things. We've shed some light on some topics. We've perhaps brightened our days of knowledge. I'm not sure. But, you know, I mean, think about even the idea of as we close out, like the metaphors of everything we talk about, like knowing something, the metaphors are visual, like shedding light on this.
Right, a light bulb clicking on.
Light bulb turning on, right? Why don't we be like, I just got this great smell in my head. You know, it's like, I'll smell you later. You know, there's other ways to think about that. But even the metaphors of our knowing are visual, right?
Our language is framed by the visual.
Yeah, it is. But anyway, hope that'll leave us with something to think about. And we'll see you all next week. Thanks for joining on This Anthropological Life. This is Adam Gamwell.
This is Ryan Collins.
And this is Anil Tripathi.